and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Absolute Broadcasting, its staff, or advertisers. It's time for Israel is Real. Two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Rahel and Sonia focus on life in modern 21st century Israel, telling the stories of ordinary people living in, loving, and in support of an extraordinary land. Israel is Real is a community-supported program featuring interviews with local, national, and international celebrities, personal life stories, and call-ins. Learn a new Hebrew word every week. Israel is Real. Every Friday on 1590 WSMN, Nashua's News and Talk. And now, your hosts, Rahel and Sonia.
Hi, we're Rachel and
Sonia.
And this is Israel is Real. Boker Tov Lekol HaMazinim.
Tzoraim Tovim b'Israel.
From WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. We like to remind you always that we are a community-supported program. We appreciate all of your donations and contributions, especially from our advertisers and all of our sponsors who love and support what we're doing on behalf of spreading the good news about Israel. So we will remind you that if you would like to make a contribution, and we are chronically fundraising, we always need your money. Thank you very much. You can visit our website at www.israelisreal.weebly.com. That's Israel is Real as one word, then dot weebly.com. And you can email us at israelisreal1590@gmail.com. And we always like to read and tell you about our sponsors, and one of them is Vision.
Did you know that Vision is an organization that educates our community about the little country of Israel? Did you know Israel is approximately about the size of New Jersey? To receive Vision's emails alert and be informed about Vision's educational activities and opportunities, please visit Vision's website at www.newhampshireforisrael.org. That's www.nh4israel.org.
Thank you, Sonia, and thank you, Vision. We'd also like to thank
to Rachel for her music.
RachelMusic.com, www.rahelmusic.com. You can also find it at rahelmusic.net, RachelMusic.com or RachelMusic.net. Available to play for your weddings, occasions, b'nai mitzvah, parties, house concerts, businesses, eateries, and as background music.
Good. It's always nice when you can thank yourself.
Well, nobody else seems to be doing it. No, I'm not kidding.
You should
I am kidding.
You should show me.
I know. Sonia, you should be doing this. Next time I'll
give it to you.
Yeah. Maybe we'll give it to George.
Sure, I'd love to.
Anyway, we are here at Israel is Real on WSMN 1590. And as we like to do, we like to teach a little bit of Hebrew, as both of us are also Hebrew teachers in our other life and in one of our many lives. And our Hebrew word for today is chidush.
And chidush comes from chadash. Chadash means new. And chidush means innovation. On the one hand, we can say Ein chadash tachat hashamesh means there's nothing new under the sun. Therefore, we don't need to work too hard to innovate or to improve or to change anything. But from the other hand, we do have Yashan bifnei chadash totzi, which means that we must replace the world with something new. And today we have a new country, Israel, which came from an old country, our country, Judea. Weaving the old with the new, we renew our cultural and the religious roots while maintaining respect for the ancient and enjoying our new miraculous creation. And this is Judaism. It is the ancient, the old, and the new. This is renewal, and this is innovation. But why I'm talking about this today?
You know, I always wonder that, Sonia.
Because we are preparing.
We like to actually, we do find relevance in the words that we choose. And the relevance today is that we have, today you'll be hearing a pre-recorded interview that we made with a man named Mr. Saul Singer. He is the co-author of a book called Startup Nation. It was very exciting to speak with Mr. Singer, and we're going to share it with you today with the savvy of foreign policy insiders. Dan Senor and Saul Singer have examined Israeli culture and government to reveal the secrets behind the world's first ever startup nation. As countries across the globe restart their own economies in this day especially, and as businesses try to re-energize their entrepreneurial spirit, we can all look to Israel for some impressive and surprising clues. So they've written a book called Startup Nation, which addresses the trillion-dollar question, how is it that Israel, a country of 7.1 million, surrounded by enemies, in a constant state of war, with no natural resources, how is it that this country produces more startup companies than large, peaceful nations, for example, like Canada, Japan, China, India, and even the UK? So our guest today, Mr. Saul Singer, he's the co-author of Startup Nation. It's a book that's available at startupnationbook.com, and we'll repeat that later. He is a columnist for the Jerusalem Post magazine and newspaper, where he also served for 6 years as the editorial page editor. Before moving to Israel, he served as foreign policy advisor in both the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. Kind of an important place to sit these days. So we're going to hear now the interview with Saul Singer. Hey, shalom, Saul.
Shalom.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I moved to Israel in 1994, almost 16 years ago. And before that, I worked on 10 years for 10 years on Capitol Hill for different members of Congress. Basically, since moving to Israel, spent most of the time at the Jerusalem Post writing editorials and a column, and eventually became editorial page editor. I took time off to write the book, Startup Nation.
Uh-huh. It's a great book.
We love the book.
It's a great book. You started and you just want to finish it. It's very nice.
Thank you.
So what motivated you and together with Dan Senor to write this book?
Well, the book was actually Dan's idea, which is, I think, largely because he was sitting in New York and I'm sitting in Jerusalem and I'm writing about the Israeli economy from a journalistic perspective, which means mostly complaining. And Dan sitting in New York and coming in from time to time and looking for startups to invest in. And he brought the first Harvard Business School student mission to Israel when he was a student at Harvard in 2001. And he was, you know, since then amazed whenever he came here at what he saw, and was always asking me about it and trying to figure out, you know, where it came from, why did it happen in Israel. And we started looking for a book on this, you know, to share with other people, to understand it ourselves. And there wasn't a book in English, and I looked in Hebrew, and there's no book in Hebrew like this. And so we decided to write it.
Every question that you put in this book are the same similar questions that people are asking us, my family, you know, every Israel that I know. And nobody was able to explain exactly how the chutzpah is going together with the yozma, and why we are in some way maybe, how shall I say, arrogant, and from the other hand, we are working together. It was very, very complex. And when I read this book, when I was amazed how nice and how beautiful you just make the point.
Thank you. I think you captured it just now, is that there are a lot of contradictions.
Right.
This doesn't mean that Israelis are good at everything.
Absolutely not.
The same things that make us good at startups in some ways make us not so good at management or building big companies or marketing. But we are very good at innovation and at entrepreneurship. And it's that combination that's very unusual and that we're arguing has produced more startups per capita than any other country. And what's produced what we see here.
Right. Well, I want to back up just for a minute. Tell us a little bit about Dan Senor and how the two of you met.
Yeah, well, Dan, we don't actually say this in the book, but we don't hide it either, is my brother-in-law.
Oh, really?
So that's easy how we met, through my wife, who's Dan's sister. But in terms of Dan's background, Dan also has a background in government. He was a press secretary to a United States senator. Of course, people began to see him more when he became a spokesman for the coalition in Iraq during Paul Bremer was essentially the governor of Iraq. Dan was stationed there and was on CNN almost every day in the daily briefings. And since then, he's been a commentator on Fox News and, in the press a lot as a foreign policy commentator, but he also has a business background in that he started a private equity fund with a partner and worked at the Carlyle Group and so on. So he's got a combination of business and government.
Now, he hasn't lived in Israel, or?
No, he's visits a lot, but mm-hmm. he's never lived here.
Okay. So going back, we mentioned that the Israeli entrepreneur style is sort of, I'm quoting your book, actually, where you said it's assertiveness versus insolence, critical independent thinking versus insubordination, and ambition and vision versus arrogance. And explaining that the words that you choose depend on your perspective, but collectively, they describe the typical Israeli entrepreneur. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the book, as you know, is a lot of stories, a book of stories. It's called The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. And I think that's how we managed to kind of paint a picture of all these contradictions. And one of the things is that Americans, we interviewed over 100 people, leaders of all kinds, business, government, and so on, and many of them outside of Israel, kind of people who we wanted to talk to find out what they thought, what their experience was working with Israelis. And you talk to Americans and, companies like Intel, Microsoft, Google, Cisco, and so on, and they talk about the difference in culture, that there is this kind of brashness, some people might call it arrogance, a way of essentially saying what's on your mind, and not much respect for authority. And some people like that, and some people don't like it. I mean, some people find it refreshing to kind of know where you stand with Israelis. They kind of say, if they have a problem with you, they say it. On the other hand, that can be grating for some people who like to kind of smooth the edges over a bit more.
Well, it works in Israel. If you talk about, you talk a lot about the military in Israel, the army service, which essentially does train people to go out in the world, and it really qualifies them to become entrepreneurs. And I know my daughter just finished her army service in Israel, and I remember her telling me about, for the first year or so or less, I don't know, you're not allowed to really become friendly with your commanding officer. And it's very disciplined, highly disciplined. And then all of a sudden they graduate to, you know, after the basic training and whatnot. And suddenly, you know, they're allowed to call them Avi and Yossi and, you know, first name basis and become friends. And it's very shocking to them at first. But they somehow learn the discipline, but then everybody becomes friendly and equal. And you talk about this. Can you tell us more about how this plays in the business world?
Yes. Well, one of the surprising things about the Israeli army is the lack of hierarchy once you get beyond the kind of basic training level, as you say. In basic training, yes, it's very disciplined and it's kind of much more standard in terms of hierarchy. But beyond basic training, and certainly in reserve, especially in reserve duty, there's basically no saluting. There's people, soldiers call their even generals by their first names and so on. And there's a willingness also even within the military to challenge authority. To, you know, if someone thinks you're doing the wrong thing, they'll tell you. The fact that this is tolerated and in some ways almost encouraged in the military spreads to the rest of society. It's something, so in other words, if the military isn't going to be very hierarchical, then civilian life is going to be even less so. And this is what you see. In fact, when the executives from Google, we talked to some of them, and they visit Google Israel, the striking thing is that they are kind of hit with, you know, tough questions and so on, and there's no real respect for the big executives coming in from, you know, California. You know, they get challenged just like everybody else. And,
right.
And what the Google, of course, is kind of famous for having, for being very flat, for being very non-hierarchical for an American company. And yet Google Israel, they find, is as I would put it, even googlier than Google. it's even flatter than Google. So that's certainly true compared to most other companies.
And so how does that create the success that we're seeing? How does that play into successful entrepreneurship?
Okay, so, well, one thing you need, there are many different kind of attributes that lend themselves to a startup culture. But one of the things is flatness in the terms of lack of hierarchy. I mean, it's startups are famous for being flat, for being, you know, not having big formal offices and not having a lot of, you know, rank or whatever structure. They're of course they're very small, so that lends itself to being that way. And they're not bureaucratic. They're very quick to turn around because they are so small. And so this flatness is not by chance. It's a function. You have to be that way in order to succeed as a startup, because you have to be very nimble. You have to be able to change direction very quickly. And companies that are larger and bureaucratic have more trouble innovating and more trouble changing than do startups. And in fact, I would say that startups are, in a sense, kind of concentrated in innovation. And that's what makes them so important in the entire global high-tech ecosystem.
I would like to bring the example that you wrote in the book about Apollo in Columbia management. Can you please tell us about this? I found it very interesting.
Yeah,
that was the space mission. Yeah.
This is a classic business school case that we drew on, comparing the Apollo mission with different companies. There are different versions of this kind of case, but basically it's it's a way that business schools try to teach and learn about how to improvise within, how to essentially teach improvisation within a company, so that you're able to deal with all kinds of eventualities. And what they found is that actually one of the cases looked, I think, at Northwest Airlines, and basically just to deal with the situations that they knew about and could predict. And instead, the contrast is with the Apollo space mission, where the training of the astronauts was to be ready for all kinds of things and just kind of to be generalist and not to pretend that you could predict what would go wrong and to train for that. But basically, we train them to do anything, to be ready for anything. And this is the kind of training that the Israeli military, this is the philosophy that the Israeli military uses in their training. And it also works well, of course, for business, because in business, you can't really predict the way things are going to go. And you need to be flexible. And you can't train for every eventuality. You have to train for the ability to be flexible. And that's what Israelis are good at, that they learn both culturally and in the military and in the startups and so on.
You mentioned about the multitasking and that together with improvisation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to sort of also, you mentioned also about, you could say that Israel, we could see that Israel is a little tiny nation surrounded by a lot of hostility, and there's a lot of pressure and tension, in the country with people living there. And this seems to work rather than bringing the country down. This, according to your book, this works in our favor, in Israel's favor. So can you expound on that?
Yeah. Well, this is a thread that runs through the entire book, is that Israel has been hit with all kinds of adversity, whether it's the lack of resources, the lack of a local market to speak of, the lack of a regional market, the boycotts, the attacks, and so on and so forth. And basically what Israel has become good at dealing with adversity. And this, it's forced Israelis to be innovative and to be entrepreneurial. It's kind of reinforced all these things. And it's also been very good in terms of dealing with downturns, because downturns, economic downturns, are just another form of adversity. So you see that Israel, when the 2000 internet bubble burst, the whole high-tech scene in Israel was quite young. And you might have thought that that would have been the end of it, because a lot of the factors that caused it to come up, like the Oslo peace process, the Russian Aliyah, the influx of about a million Russians over a decade, the world economy, the state of the world, the positive state of the world, all these things were central in creating the boom in the late 90s. But then they just about all disappeared. The Oslo process fell apart, the Russians stopped coming, the world economy went south, and yet the Israeli high-tech scene didn't disappear. In fact, it actually got stronger in that. If you look at the amount of venture capital, the proportion that Israel received in 2000, it was actually higher in 2005, despite the Intifada, despite all these factors going wrong. Israel got a larger share of venture capital in 2005 than it did in 2000. And the same's happening now with the current downturn. So what you see now, in addition, is that the venture capital in Israel has gone down substantially in the current downturn, and by about 40% in 2009. But in the U.S., it's gone down 59%. So you see, once again, that Israel's kind of increasing its market share even during a downturn.
We're speaking with Saul Singer, the co-author of Startup Nation, and we're speaking directly to Israel. This is actually a pre-recorded interview, and we'll be back on WSMN 1590, Israel is Real.
WSMN
and WSMNradio.com.
The Telegraph, keeping you connected to your community for pennies a day. When news breaks, the Telegraph is there. When the community needs a watchdog, the Telegraph is there. When it's time to celebrate the accomplishments of our young athletes and scholars, the Telegraph is there. The Telegraph has been recognized for 7 years in a row as the best small daily newspaper. America counts. Find out how the 2010 census will affect you in a series of articles on our nation's most important headcount.
Sassy!
Today's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Oh, nuts! There's a bobcat in this cave! Save us, Sassy!
You will, but first you'd like to stress the importance of cat adoption? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year and they need to be adopted?
Help us, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
You're receiving Downtown Nashua's other free wireless service. No computer required. We're 1590 WSMN.
We're back with Israel is Real. We're two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Please visit our website at www.israelisreal.weebly.com, israelisreal.weebly.com, and listen to us every Friday from 10 to 11 in the morning. We are always grateful for our sponsors, and one of our wonderful sponsors is Vern Main. Countries depend for much of their success and security on their intellectual prowess and advanced technology. Many companies from here and abroad depend on the patent attorneys at Vern Main and Associates to obtain U.S. or global patent protection for their new ideas. Vern Main and Associates is an intellectual property law firm right here in Nashua. For professional legal counseling on all intellectual property matters, contact the legal specialists at Vern Main and Associates at their offices on 100 Main Street in Nashua, New Hampshire, or on the web at vernmain.com. That's www.vernmaine.com, vernmain.com. And we're back speaking again with a pre-recorded interview with Saul Singer, co-author of Startup Nation.
I kind of like the stories in the book about the war stories, so to speak. I forget his name now. The one who, Israel Aircraft Industries, how they built, you know, they just went ahead and ignored kind of the rules and built up the aircraft from, what was it, like, you know, comparing it with the Jeep with the tools?
Yes.
And stories like that. It's just, it also seems like something that Israel has, I think the motivation is not money, which is very different in, for example, in America. The motivation is to make money, and that doesn't seem to be the case in Israel. What would you say about that?
Well, that's another thing that came up when we talked to Americans and others who were looking at Israelis. They were struck by how Israel as a country has a sense of purpose that's maybe not as obvious in other countries. And this is a comment they had kind of overall, but it's also, I think, something that comes from the military service, in that one of the biggest things that comes out of the military service is patriotism, is the idea that you are working, you are sacrificing, you are putting your life in danger for something larger than yourself. And that's not an experience that people necessarily get in academia. or in business. But it's something that helps you, that changes you and how you live your life and how you relate to your country, how you relate to business. I think we see it in Israelis. And this also goes to what one of the things, the big things that we are suggest as a lesson for America, which is, I mean, this is the clearest one, which is take advantage of the military talent coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan, of the experience of these veterans who are coming back. You know, some of them have, like, run small towns, and they've had to make split-second decisions, life and death decisions, and control, you know, millions of dollars of equipment and commanding lots of people. And if they come back to the United States, and they're often hit with, you know, sitting in a job interview, and they'll be asked, well, what kind of real work experience have you had? And they just don't get it, that this experience is very valuable for business. In Israel, it's the opposite. Everybody, any employer looking at a prospective someone they want interested in hiring, the first thing they'll look at is their military resume, what they did in the Army, because that will tell them, you know, the kind of unit they served, what rank they achieved, and so on and so forth, will tell them the kind of skills that they bring to the table. So in Israel, this is understood. In the United States and other countries, there's a kind of an illiteracy when it comes to reading a military resume, and that's a shame because it's wasted talent.
It's like asking a pilot if he is multitasking. It's clear that the pilot is a multitasking person, not a question about, and still you can have this kind of questions.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly pilots and people from certain very tech-oriented units are very sought after in the Israeli economy. Right. But it's not just those. It's not just that small group, relatively small group. It's also, you know, if you were an officer in the infantry, you got a lot of these kind of values and skills in terms of leadership, teamwork, being mission-oriented, a level of maturity, and all these kinds of things. It's not necessarily exposure to technology. But then there are certain units in the Israeli military that also give the soldiers a lot of experience with technology, and that's an even greater boost, and a lot of those people end up doing involved in startups.
I think the other another point that you made in your book was about understanding failure, being very self-critical, and understanding failure that points you in the end toward success. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, well, tolerance for failure is probably the most important attribute for a culture that's entrepreneurial. In other words, if you look at one of the important things we're saying in the book is that it's not that Jews or Israelis are so smart. Okay, there's a lot of misconception here. A lot of people, I think, like to think that the reason Israel is so successful and innovative is that it's just smart.
The Jews are the
great. The Jews are smart, right?
Yeah. And
we are. We know we are. No,
well,
kidding.
Okay, maybe we are, but the point we're making is that there are a lot of smart people in the world. Exactly. If you look at Finland or Japan or Korea, places like this, you will see that the number of patents per capita is at least is on the same order as Israel, and sometimes more. So that you can't say that these people are not smart and not innovative. They are. Now the question, but the difference is that if you're an innovative person, say in Finland, you'll go into Nokia, probably. Or if you're in Korea, you might go into Samsung. But in Israel, you're much more likely to do a startup.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that here, we don't just have the innovative piece, we also have the entrepreneurial piece. And they're not the same thing. A lot of people use the words interchangeably, they're not. In terms of entrepreneurship, the fear of failure is a huge factor. And if you're in a country where if you fail, you lose face and you're not allowed to try again, it's not accepted, you're not going to be go into a startup. It's too risky. But in Israel, it's understood that failure is part of success, that most startups fail, and that most successful entrepreneurs have failed before. And this is understood. So that kind of understanding is critical for any sort of startup environment to exist.
Definitely.
It's any spiritual connection that motivates the Israeli? I mean, because the tradition, because the religion?
Yeah. One of the things I think we probably could have dealt with more in the book that we didn't is how much of this is Jewish, and how much comes from Jewish history and Jewish religion and culture and so on. And not just from the last 60 years or including the pioneering times, say the last 100 years. We do touch on that, and we do point out that, you know, that the Jewish emphasis on education for thousands of years has led Israel to start, you know, world-class universities in the 1920s, long before the state was founded. And that was critical to all, you know, the fact that the Weizmann Institute, the Technion and Hebrew University are such world-class institutions is a function of the Jewish kind of reverence for education. It's also true in terms of, I would argue, in terms of the brashness, the chutzpah, that sort of begins in the Bible with the story of Abraham challenging God over Sodom and arguing right. with God over the destruction of Sodom. I mean, if you're willing to argue with God, of course you're willing to argue with
the boss,
with the executive from Google. so you know, it makes us. We have a culture of challenging, of debate, of questioning, and this is clearly part of Israeli culture as well. So some of it comes from Jewish history. And so on, and some of it is more from, you know, recent history and Israeli experience.
I wanted to just go back a little bit and talk about this idea of I'm not quite sure how to say it, of working within the rules and sort of stepping out of the rules, you know, going over the boundaries. I remember seeing a piece about a man who was developing some kind of walking wheelchair that could go upstairs and down the stairs, and he designed it sort of almost like a tank. The wheels turned into a tank that could climb stairs. And I remember the interview with him was, this was not in your book, but, you know, he said, why, you know, this was an American who chose to be in Israel and work on his project. He said, why did you choose to be in Israel? And he said, because I don't have the same rules. I can do what I want. Nobody's telling me that I can only do this or only do that. I'm allowed to explore whatever comes to my head. What can you tell us about something like that? The, you know, working as opposed to working within the rules and outside of the rules, outside of the box.
Yeah. Well, Israelis like to improvise, and they learn part of the business of being under adversity, which another word for that is being under a scarcity of resources. If you're constantly dealing with the resource constraints, that forces you to improvise. And in fact, it's interesting to see that if you look at the American military in Iraq or Afghanistan, where normally the American military is very large. And the opposite of resource constraint. They have plenty of resources, this is certainly compared to Israel. But if you look in Iraq or Afghanistan, you see that they suddenly, because the job they have to do is so great and the number of troops they have is relatively small on the ground, that they become resource constrained. And when they become resource constrained, they improvise just like Israelis. So in some ways, it's not... it's not that, that Israelis are so special. It's that we've always been under this, these constraints, and it's forced us to improvise. And of course, improvising is a key part of innovation. I mean, improvisation and innovation are kind of close cousins. And it, if you get good at improvising, you become more creative. You start thinking more out of the box, as they say, and it leads to all these crazy inventions of things. You know, taking say a military technology like the one in the nose cones of airplanes and turning it into a pill that you can swallow to take pictures inside your intestines.
Right.
You know, those kind of crazy ideas come from this kind of tradition, you could say, of improvising.
Sort of, we're all a bunch of MacGyvers. If you remember that
yeah.
TV show.
Right.
Maybe we could talk a little bit more specifically about some of the examples you mentioned in the book. For example, you started off right off the bat with the story about Shai Agassi and the electric
right.
car and the whole grid. And I understand that's coming up pretty soon. Do you know when that's happening?
That's right. That's right. The according to their schedule, and they claim to be on schedule, and they will see in late this year, 2010, we're going to see the first cars going around test driving on the system, meaning using the charge points and the swap stations, battery swap stations, fully electric cars. And by 2011, the public at large will be able to buy these cars, you know, in the dealership. And I hope to be one of the first to buy one of these cars, because I think that what's going to happen is that, you know, a lot of people don't know what to think about a fully electric car. They think it's like that they won't be powerful, they won't be convenient, they'll be too expensive, they'll be this, they'll be that. And I think they don't quite understand that this the system that Better Place came up with is actually going to make the electric cars at least as economical, at least as convenient, and certainly much more environmentally friendly than the gas car. And I think what's going to happen is when they see Israelis, Israel is going to be the first country that's going to adopt this whole system countrywide. When they see it working in Israel and in Denmark, which is happening there about the same time, people who experience it are going to wonder, you know, what they were thinking with gas cars, and they'll never want to go back.
I liked how you connected the whole idea of what to do. How do you change the battery and connected that with, you know, how they load missiles onto airplanes, you know, the same kind of technology.
Yeah. The mechanism that holds the key to this to the Better Place model is that you can swap the battery. You can drive into something that looks maybe a little like a car wash. You don't even have to get out of the car, and from under the car, a robot takes the battery out of your car and puts a new one in about 1 minute. And you're good to go for, you know, another, you know, 100 miles or so. But what people also don't think about is that with most of the time with an electric car, you charge it every night at home or at the office. So you don't have to go into a swap station if you are driving less than, say, 100 miles a day. And most people drive an average, say, 40 miles a day. You could go for years without ever going into a swap station, just recharging your battery all the time, every day, at night, while you sleep, or at the office while you're at work.
Like a cell phone.
So it's much more convenient than a gas car, which you have to put gas in every once in a while when the gas runs out. I think the people are going to find this to be much superior to gas cars. They just can't get used to the idea. I mean, the gas car has been around for basically 100 years. We're looking at kind of car 2.0. It's taken 100 years to come up with a different way of doing a car. And so it's very hard for people to get their heads around something different. But like I said, I don't think there'll be any turning back once the system is out there.
Yeah, I can't wait. I wanted to also, maybe we have two more questions. One, I noticed that Shimon Peres's name comes up quite a lot, and even Bibi Benjamin Netanyahu comes up a lot in having a lot to do with helping these a lot of businessmen and these innovations to get off the ground.
That's right.
Yeah, can you? Sort of, I know Bibi had a hand in privatizing many things, which I was against at the time. I remember living there, but apparently it paid off. And Shimon Peres seems to be behind a lot of things. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, Netanyahu deserves a lot of credit for freeing up the Israeli economy, both when he was prime minister in '96 and then later on when he was finance minister under Ariel Sharon in the 2003 time frame. Basically, Israel started in its first 20 years or so, 30 years, with a very government-dominated and almost socialist top-down economy. And that economy, I mean, that structure worked very well for the first 20 years. I mean, Israel grew faster and more consistently than it's ever grown since in the first 20 years from 1950 to 1970. So I don't want to completely knock the kind of that top-down socialist system. It was very successful, but it hit a wall basically when the economy grew to a certain level. And and Bibi deserves a lot of credit for transforming the economy from that top-down economy to a bottom-up startup-based economy. And there's, I think, a lot more to do, not so much in the startups in the high-tech sphere, but in the rest of the economy. The rest of the economy is still overtaxed, over-regulated, and also over-concentrated. There's not enough competition. On the high-tech side, you don't have any of that. You have a good tax situation. It's not much regulatory burden. And certainly not over concentrated. It's very diffuse, very competitive. So we really need to make the rest of our economy more like the high tech side.
Mm-hmm. And Shimon Peres seemed to be during those earlier years, and maybe even now, was very motivational.
Peres is very interesting. We spent hours interviewing him, which is fascinating because his career spans both. Really all three periods of the Israeli economy, the initial kind of pioneering socialist government top-down phase, what's called the lost decade where everything kind of hit a wall, and then the current time of the high-tech success. Peres was intimately involved in all of it, and in fact was basically an entrepreneur on the government level. He would use the government as a tool to start whole industries like the aircraft industry or the nuclear industry and so on. And he still thinks in terms of creating new industries. He's in his 80s, but, you know, he's still talking about this. We need to foster nanotechnology. We need to be a leader in clean tech and so on and so forth. And so it was fascinating to interview him, and I think he did end up being the person who was most quoted in our book.
Yeah, he is definitely, I mean, whether you like his politics or not, he's definitely a man of vision, and for that I've always respected him a lot.
That's right, yes.
Like I said before, this book is a joy to read, and I smiled a lot when I read the book. And
you.
I can relate very much to the lives of the authors. The dedication, however, touched me very deep, because the dedication is to James Senor, which is then Senor's father, and the second dedication is for Alex Zinger, which is your brother, who was fall in a military mission at age
That's
of
right.
25. And I couldn't stop thinking that it is the Israeli way. You are living and you are always remember the people which are not around. And
if I may, I just since you mentioned Alex, I would encourage your listeners to look at the website that we created and the book of Alex's letters and art. The book is called Alex Building a Life, and you can read more about it at alexsinger.org. And also the website for our own book is startupnationbook.com.
Yes. And in my humble opinion, this is also the personal drive that motivates people to invent, to rethink, to do something that others have envisioned and suddenly in the middle of their life they disappeared.
Yes.
And somehow I felt that this is something that, you know, when you are doing something for yourself, it's something else, and when you are doing something for somebody else in the memory of somebody else, it is much more deeper. You feel that you are really obligated to finish it.
Right. Yes. Dan and I thought a lot about his father and my brother as we were writing the book, because they both passed away before this whole high-tech scene came about. I mean, my brother fell in 1987, and Dan's father died when he was just 13. They missed it. They missed seeing this, and they would have really appreciated it. And in their own lives, they worked for it to happen.
Right.
1590 WSMN
and WSMNRadio.com.
For a limited time only.
There, it's all set up. Our new 60-inch flat-screen TV in our home theater. We've got hundreds of channels to choose from. We'll always be in touch with the latest information and entertainment.
That's great, dear. But what do we do if the power goes out? Like last winter during the ice storm? We were out of power and without communications for more than a week.
Oh, yeah. I had forgotten about that.
We've been speaking with Saul Singer in a pre-recorded interview. Saul Singer's book is Startup Nation and can be found at startupnationbook, all one word, .com. Startupnationbook.com. This is Rachel and
Sonia.
This is Israel is Real. We'd like to wish everybody
Shabbat Shalom
and Chag Pesach Kasher V'Sameach, and WSMN 1590, Israel is Real.
See the hillside over yonder, there's my baby over there. At his doorstep he's singing a lullaby.
To the news of the day.
Because communication is the beginning of understanding.
1590.